call to order this meeting of the Customer Service Committee. Roll call, please.
Committee Chair Director Reddick.
Here.
Director Bank.
Here.
Director Towns.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Under the first line of business, under the Committee Chairman section, I would take a motion for approval of the minutes of the September 20th, 2012 committee.
Motion approved.
Second.
Are there any amendments, changes, deletions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by stating aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? That passes. Under Chairman's report, everybody's aware of the fact that this week on Monday we went live with the dispute resolution form. That's the form that we talked about. We anticipate a little over 90% of our potential disputes at this point will be able to be resolved through the submission of information using the website and that form. And it's up and running. We've had people that have used it for submissions, and quite anxious to see how that impacts improving our customer service and to better maximizing our staff time. So the other thing that I guess just to make the committee aware of, we are any day, perhaps even today, preparing to issue the RFP for the back room system. I know that we spent a lot of time, we talked about that, put some information into it. And as soon as that actually goes out, I'll make sure that the committee's aware of that. That's a, that'll be good to get that out and run.
Yep, we'll send out a notice probably later today that it's been posted.
That's all I have. I would turn it over to Christy and the issues under Executive Director.
Great, thank you very much. Well, briefly, we have the committee work plan. I'll turn it over to Shauna. As you know, we created this work plan at the beginning of the year to try to tackle the many issues that we knew we wanted to deal with in customer service. And we can have a quick progress report, and then I think just move into the presentation. I know we have an update on violations framework. We wanted to get your feedback on some changes that we think would be advisable there, and then also wanted to share with you the feedback we've gotten from the customer survey that you've directed us to do on feedback transponders. So that's some interesting information there. So, Shauna?
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
On the second slide, we have just a quick recap of our work plan. Phase one in progress part there refers to the violations framework, where we'll talk today a little bit about settlement guidelines that we have in place and some of the thoughts about how we might be able to evolve those to better match business needs and customer service needs in the future. And then the other items do remain in progress, the fleet policies, which of course will be addressed in the biggest part by this RFP that will be posted soon, and the feedback transponders, which we'll talk through the survey results about today. If we move to the next slide,
we actually have to go to the next presentation, I think.
Oh, I do?
Yeah.
There we are. Mm-hmm. Okay. We can talk a little bit about our violations framework. And I wanted to talk through and just make sure that we all understood kind of where it currently stands, how we manage settlements right now, according to our settlement guidelines, which are posted on our website, and which our CSRs, our customer service representatives, refer to all the time, and kind of why we might want to consider creating greater flexibility going forward, because our customer service needs might be a little bit deeper or more nuanced than the guidelines really had originally outlined. So the current guidelines have the following major parameters. If you're an IPAS customer and you call in before the second notice, you can just pay the cash toll rate. If you're an IPAS customer and you call in before the due date on the second notice, you can pay the cash rate of the toll and then some number of the $20 fine. If you call as an IPAS customer even after that due date, same thing, cash toll and some portion of the $20 fine. If you're non-IPAS though, you can only access these types of settlements if you can add your plate to an IPAS account, and you'd have to have the same name or address, one or the other, of the IPAS account holder. And you, that's really it, the name or address of the IPAS account holder. So some of the reasons that that we've seen come across our desk that we might want to consider greater flexibility are noted below here. These are just a couple of key examples. The first one there is the registered owner does not live full-time at the listed address. They are responsible for listing the address in their ICAP account, but there are people who spend huge portions of time away from their main address. And by the time mail gets forwarded, because we do have a 21-day and a 14-day notice cycle, it's often too late for them to access the parameters of our existing settlement guidelines. Then another one that we do see, not with great frequency, but it's not completely unheard of either, is that one of our own customer service representatives will actually create a data entry error. You know, they'll be on the phone and they'll be taking somebody's email address, their plate, and they type it all in and they read it back, but somehow the data that they've entered isn't quite correct. Numbers are transposed, letters are transposed, and then the courtesy notifications don't go out, or the plate doesn't get found when a missed toll occurs, and it really was just related to that human error on our end. Those are two examples of things that we struggle with at present to address because our settlement guidelines are, you know, have the parameters that they have.
How does an IPS customer have a violation?
They typically have a violation because their plate isn't on the IPAS account and they don't have a transponder in the car. That's the one that you see the most frequently. Or the one that you see kind of the second most frequently is they have let their account balance go negative. And they've let it go negative for so long that even the time period we give them to self-correct it, you know, to correct that account balance before a violation gets announced, they exceed even that. So it goes to violation.
Is that because the credit card doesn't get charged?
There are a couple of reasons. They're on for the ones who are on auto replenish, where the credit card should get just charged on a regular basis. In some cases, it has expired, although we've taken major leaps forward in managing that because we now work directly with the banks to update the expiration dates to the extent that the bank let us. Not all the banks agree to do this, but a number of them do. Sometimes it will actually just get declined because something else has happened to that credit card. Maybe it got stolen and that account got closed down, but they forgot to go into their ICAS account and update it.
And one issue, I remember one instance where, again, because the contact information had been entered incorrectly, somebody wasn't getting the notices that their credit card wasn't working, you know, so then they get a violation notice and I think they maybe even had been out of town for the first one, so it escalated to the second one. And just, you know, it's a fairness question, too, where we want to try to be as fair as possible.
Correct. But the only way we would know and they would know that their credit card wasn't working anymore is if they got a violation, right? So that's what triggers it and boosts the amount.
Right. And we do look for that proactively. We look for active accounts where there are missed tolls waiting in queue because there's a negative balance. And we do robocalling. We send out tons of emails. We send out postcards. But sometimes if somebody hasn't kept all their information up to date, they just don't get those courtesy notifications. And then it's terrible because, of course, we hate sending out violation notices. It's not what we want to do. And it's terrible for them because they think that they're an IPAS account holder and it's all taken care of.
And again, the instances that I've seen are often less about the individual not keeping their account up to date, although that certainly happens and there's some responsibility they take for that. But sometimes they maybe attempt to by calling into our customer service and there's been some mistake on our end. So that's particularly where I think, you know, the flexibility to try to make something right for somebody is, I think, a little bit more urgent.
If someone doesn't have a credit card, could they come into the facility here and give $1,000 and say, you know, put it on my account and I'll work it off? We would do that
for
somebody?
And you'll sometimes do that with
$100 or whatever.
Like smaller fleet companies that prefer to pay not on a credit card basis. So there are a portion of our customers who do proactively go online or come in or mail a check-in.
So they prepay, basically.
Right. Well, even the auto replenishments are prepaid, technically, but yeah. they'll prepay on a cash basis. But that requires them to be very proactive about it. And if anything happens that prevents them from making that next payment proactively, then it might go negative. Which is, you know, again, the type of situation that we want to help people prevent. And if they've done everything they can to help prevent it, we want to help them deal with it in a positive way on the other side if they end up with a violation.
Is there any way to judge of all of the violations you have, how many would fall into this category?
Which, when you say this category, which
where
are
there's
referring
a,
to?
Let's call it an honest mistake or an honest problem.
I mean, I think we send out 5,000 violation notices a day, typically. And so, you know, we've all seen kind of the handful of calls of people explaining these types of stories. We don't have the ability right now with our current call center and customer service center and system to necessarily track, to generate a report to know, you know, how many came in with, you know, CSR, customer service representative error of some type or what have you. So it's often the ones that where we just hear about things, you know,
you don't
hear about things happening.
Anecdotally, what percentage?
Well, I mean, it would be less than 1%.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
very small
percentage.
Which I think maybe goes to the point of the settlement guideline.
And I know that there's been discussion, and we've, in this committee, have actually talked about this. You know, there's two guides to this. We've got the violation policy, which we've talked a little bit about in making these amendments. And I kind of see this as really a lead-in almost to that to some extent. And I think what you're looking for from this committee, and jump in and let me know if I'm wrong here, is, I mean, we need to, a recognition that this is an issue that we do want to provide some greater flexibility. And then I know there have been discussions going on with legal and finance and to try and kind of come up with the parameters of what that may or may not be. But I guess at this point, I turn it over to the committee. And I guess the first issue is that what we're looking for? Do we want to endorse and have the staff go forward to come up with some greater flexibility in these settlement guidelines? And then number two, if there's any specific guidelines or things that we'd like them to consider, if we do that, I think now is probably the time to present that to make sure we're heading in the right direction.
Well, I'm for flexibility.
Yes. I think that goes towards the other discussion that we're having as far as the violation policy as well. We've talked about making this, you know, making sure that we're treating people rather than being a punitive type of system, more of a customer-based system. And I think providing that flexibility is a good first step. I think it's one that kind of some common sense that goes along with, you know, these other changes, including putting the online dispute form on there. I think that's just a natural progression. So. It seems to me like the committee's unanimous in support of that. To that end, are there any particular issues that we want to make sure that they address or concerns that we have that we want them to avoid as they go forward and bring forth a proposal to us?
It's always a balance between making sure there's strong enough enforcement that people don't feel that they can on the one hand and on the other hand making sure that the people who would make an honest mistake or have a problem end up getting the flexibility. And that's something that's always going to be, I think, you're going to have to leave enough discretion in the process, right? So that Shauna or some group of people here will look at those cases and be able to say, this is what happened and this is why we have to be able to give a little flexibility.
I think My view is kind of a common sense approach to this, and then of course that puts the onus on David to come up with some way of codifying that and coming up with a written policy for that. But you know, I know that there were discussions going on, and if there's specific things that you guys see as potentially troublesome as we go down this, you know, I'd ask you to kind of bring that to us. But at this point, I defer to you guys and ask you to.
Right.
Collectively come together and put together a proposal on what we can take a look at, and then we can vet it from there.
Great.
Right.
We will do that.
The only other thing, if some of this is error on the part of the people who are doing the calls, just as we're going forward with the new call center, if there's a way of sort of tracking to make sure that if there's a person or a particular part of the process that causes more errors than others, can we address and figure out how to minimize that and shoot for the call?
I think that the tracking of these types of issues and kind of that quality control will really be able to be improved once we have the new system in place, because they are relying on the back office system and that's how we would track. But we can work with the new vendor to see if there's, you know, how cumbersome it would be to do something manually.
There, one thing that actually will help a little bit is the new system will have greater controls over each field where data is being entered. So that potential errors might get caught a little better, or somebody will have to reconfirm once they've typed something in, things that don't really exist today. Already today, when we can trace an error backwards, we do actually talk to the customer service representative and we train them. If things are egregious, we take even further action. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it's usually just try and track it back and make sure people have the appropriate training. Well, then that takes us to the next slide, which is about our feedback transponder survey. I don't know, Chris, if you wanted to say anything or just let me talk a little bit about it.
This is a survey that we talked about, and I think you had directed us to go out and get some more customer input on feedback transponders. They're obviously have been popular with a certain segment of our customer base who have them from many years ago. They're now beginning to age out. And you know, batteries are dying, so we have to get them back. But as you can see, 70,000 responses. It was a pretty good response rate of people who were at least interested enough to give us their opinions. So,
of the people who responded, the vast majority have private accounts with just one or two transponders. They're essentially family accounts. Only about 1% of the respondents identified as commercial. But the most striking thing is the respondents indicated overwhelmingly that yes, they would like to have a feedback transponder. I don't think that's surprising. But fewer than 20% said that they would be willing to pay extra for it.
That's kind of America right now.
Maybe
yes.
No,
not.
You come back then.
And then of the people who said they would be willing to pay, they overwhelmingly preferred a one-time fee versus a monthly fee. Only about 30% said they'd be willing to pay more than $10 as a one-time fee, and only about 30% indicated they'd be willing to pay more than $1 a month if they had to get a monthly charge. Which is good information for us to have as we try to understand what the cost really would be to move to feedback transponders if everybody wanted one but didn't want to pay for it.
Now, the last time we asked this question, as I recall, the percentage of the respondents who said they'd be willing to pay was higher than this time.
I agree. I think it was in 2009 that it was higher than.
Yeah, I think it was in the 30s, right? 32% or something in that neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall whether there were 70,000 responses.
Yeah, this is a
pretty good response.
Yeah,
it is.
Well, I took the survey, and I think that just the way it was presented, you went to the next screen, and it was kind of like, "Do you want it? Yeah, I really want it. Do you want to pay for it?" No, I mean, I can see how that's a natural response. It may have been people that they were opening the negotiations. No, I don't want to pay anything. So you tell me what you think it's worth, and then we'll go from there.
It's possible if we went out there with it, you'd find more of an appetite once people really had the option.
And some idea of what you're really looking for.
Would there be an option? You could either have the feedback or the not feedback.
Well, it's being tested right now. The feedback transponders are being tested with new readers, which we've got a little bit here in a moment on that. But I think that the idea would be yes, because the feedback transponder would be more costly. It would be a higher price point for the transponder itself, although we haven't gotten, I think, an actual price back yet from the vendor, we're pretty confident that it's going to be higher.
About $3 higher.
$3 more.
Yeah. No matter how many?
Correct. Part of the contract.
So there's no economy of scale if we made everybody, not suggesting
not
you,
beyond what's already in there, because it's based on that easy catch contract, but correct. The other factor is that we would probably have to make it something people could opt into, because right now, as you all know, we're doing these swap outs if batteries die, and we do that proactively, and people are just given what they're given. They're given the one other transponder that we have right now. But if all those people who got them this year, next year, or the year following, wanted a feedback transponder, they would still have a perfectly good transponder that we would have wasted that money on giving them. So we'd have to, you'd almost see if you didn't have the option or some sort of price point that everybody would just flood the system and say, just swap them all out right now.
And they are more costly for us, but also there's a certain amount of cost that we would have to incur with the new ones to make them fully functional and operational with our system, right? I mean, we're refreshing our lane technology anyway, so the readers and antennas and things in the lane to be able to receive them, but I think there'd be some programming.
There
correct?
Would be a little bit of programming in our system, but if, I don't know if we'd truly move that price point, probably not, but you're right. I mean, it's a bigger complexity than just here's the new
handball. And the other thing that we talked about is at last month's meeting, we renewed the contract with Juul, which was on a per unit or per item basis. So I guess, you know, part of the question is if we expected to see this massive uptake, there would be a cost associated with that. Aside from the people that are coming in other ways and that were figured into what we anticipate, our volume loads, there would be an uptake on that. And I mean, recapturing that is, we know what those costs are for the contract. So even a math guy like me is, you know, going to get close on that. So
is the feedback a beep or a light?
Okay. But the new ones don't have, I mean, some of the older models had an actual readout of the toll or how much, right? Mm-hmm. And the new ones don't have that functionality.
Presumably due to safety considerations that are newer.
You know, we had that.
Yeah, right.
Really?
Yeah.
I would.
I still have it. And you
well,
can
don't let anybody know. They might break into your car and steal it.
And you, you could see your balance on your account.
Yeah.
And a fee.
I think you got a lot of notices for that thing to come back, probably.
I just tell my mom. Just kidding.
On the next slide, we just quickly recap.
Can I ask another crazy question? Has anybody commented on the color?
The color?
Of a transponder?
No.
Mm-hmm. Just so you know.
Which color would you prefer?
Yeah, tell me.
Well, just so you know, I had this argument 95, 96. I said, why are they white? Nobody's car is white. Why not have a dark color? Again, I mean, very few car interiors are white. They're
right.
Mostly all gray, dark.
Well, and it really stands out against a windshield.
And it really
stands
out.
Color.
Do they exist? Do darker colors exist?
The capacity to produce them exists in theory. The EasyPass group as a whole had made that choice many years ago and stuck with it. So there has not been the ordering of a new.
Well, you can
line
see that I was
color.
Not effective in lodging.
Maybe we could go with like a whole accessories
right.
Part downstairs. You know, you can get your covers to match your car interior.
Oh, those covers kill me. Yeah. It, well, I'm always worried that they interfere with signal.
It just seems kind of odd to have a white when it's really stands out.
Yeah, I think that there are other people who would prefer to have a darker colored one. I know one person who's sitting at this table who offered to test any black one in their new vehicle, but was denied.
I don't know.
I won't name any names. But we'll look into it because I think that would be another thing that, it, you know, think that there's a lot of sensitivity to something new driving a lot of people to switch or swap out perfectly good transponders to get something that they want and thus escalating costs. But I think there are probably ways for us to control that, and if there's something that people would be more likely to mount correctly because it's not something they think of as ugly in their car or what have you, then it's a benefit.
I know a lot of people, and again, in my little world, who
prefer
the other dark color.
Dark color. Or maybe don't mount it all the time because they think it's not very attractive.
Right.
Understood. Yeah, I agree. If I had a choice. This next slide, which is just a reminder of the timeline for new for feedback transponders, we are the only EZCAS agency, a member of that group, that has officially demonstrated interest in feedback transponders. Others may follow, but we're the only ones who officially requested the equipment to test and all of that. It would take probably about 2 years to get this up and running because, again, we would need the new lane equipment. And then there's actually an important note just to keep in mind there at the bottom. CAPCH is the organization, of course, that provides the transponders and the readers and the lane antennas. Right now, you have to, at least with their existing technology, make a choice between a reader that will read feedback transponders or a reader that would be multi-protocol, that would read transponders that were not EZCAS transponders, transponders from Florida, transponders from California, Texas. Now, the reason that's important is because multi-protocol readers are probably the future of interoperability, at least in the nearer term. With the legislation, federal legislation on the books, that the nation needs to be interoperable on some level in the next 4 years, the most likely way that will be achieved is by all the tollways using multi-protocol readers so they can read each other's tags. The EZCAS group, especially us as members of it, are in relatively deep discussions with CAPCH trying to get them to combine this technology before we purchase anything for our lane so that we don't lose out. We would hate to buy all the lane equipment, put it all in place, and have feedback transponders, and then run into a problem where we couldn't do multi-protocol. CAPCH actually does think, at least initially right now, that they probably can get those two functionalities together into one reader, and probably in time for us to benefit from that. But that's not 100% guaranteed, and so I just thought people should maybe know that's part of the overlaying context.
And that's something that I think has become more clear in the last couple of months than when we even originally put feedback transponders on the radar.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
So
better understood now.
Interoperability, I think, is something that we all know is going to be important in the future. And we just wanted to give people a heads up that it may, although hopefully there'll be innovations that will overcome it, but it may be that having this feedback capacity would limit our ability to be truly interoperable. We'd still have the EZCAS states that we could be interoperable with,
right.
But to the extent we wanted to accept Colorado's technology or you know, Florida's or any other states, it would become more difficult.
Shauna, the feedback transponders, they're currently being tested.
The EZCAS group just essentially finished testing and it's fine with the protocols, and then we have the reader and we're about to get the actual transponders to test. So the one that I passed around here a couple months ago doesn't have all the innards of an actual transponder. It was truly just a prototype to show how it would look and sound, but the real prototypes are on their way to us, at which point we'll test to make sure that they do indeed work with our system. I think in a way we really led the industry in finding the accuracy of our lanes. So we're actually a really good test site for this sort of thing. And even though the EZCAS group has tested it, we should use our own lane knowledge to do it ourselves too.
And do we anticipate starting that right around the first of the year or before?
I would hope a little bit before. I think it depends when they actually show up on our doorstep in the package.
May I ask a question? I assume that interoperability doesn't mean that Florida and Colorado and others will say, why don't we just become part of the easy passes?
I think the easy pass group would love that. It would make our life easier.
Yeah, but in terms of, to the extent that we predict, that's not the way it's going to go. So this conflict is, conflict of technology is going to continue.
Mm-hmm. They've all made tremendous investments in their own infrastructure. For whatever reason, they didn't opt to do it that way. When they opened their systems, and I think you're right that it would be it's unlikely that they would then do a total switch over to go to a different technology. So, but you know, clearly it's going to become more and more of an issue, and you know, particularly for states I think like Illinois, which is on the outskirts of the EasyPass network, where frankly we might want to be able to look west to have some interoperability, where you know states like Ohio may not care as much about having interoperability with Colorado, for instance, or western states we're a little further and closer to them, so we might want to. And I do think that's potential. If you want, we can move on, and I can present the next item.
Yeah.
No, it's no problem. Go ahead and take a break, so that we can't allow you to expire.
We're
going to take all the calls. So I assume we still want to prioritize interoperability. We've talked about it before, but I
think that's a big part of, you know, as a customer service committee. I mean, I think that's a big part of what we want to do is offering and promoting views and buying into our system. And I know that's the groups that we're members of, that's an issue for them, and I want to make sure that we maintain that as a priority. I do have concerns about making major investments that would ultimately, in short term, ace us out of that type of multi-jurisdictional use, I guess.
Okay, good.
So then we are...
I don't have any additional items, so then I think we're on to the...
Yeah, we will have one item. We have one item for consideration and passing along to the board under business systems, and that's the award of the IGOR contract. And this is one, as I understand it, this is the group. We passed the JUUL contract. This is the contract for the people that actually do the providing of getting the merchandise, the transponders to JUUL and to the distribution centers.
Yep.
And we put this out for bidding. Were they the only responsive?
They were the only responsive bidder. So this is, again, our retail distribution. Transponders and gift cards are available at more than 180 retail outlets. More than 50% of new transponders and 85% of replacement transponders are processed through retail outlets, primarily JUUL, as we've talked about. So, you know, this distribution is an important part of our network. IGOR is the winning bidder on this procurement. This was competitively bid. They have been doing the service for the tollway, so this is the incumbent. It's a certified woman-owned business enterprise, so it's a BEP company, if you're familiar with that designation from previous contracts. For fulfillment and distribution services, IGOR has been in this business for more than 30 years, so they have a good track record. We've had good experience with them. The contract's a five-year contract in the amount of $12.5 million. It is, as you mentioned, Chair, it was the only proposal that was evaluated. There were other proposals submitted. There were four responses in total, but three of them were not evaluated because they were not complete. And I believe that they were not complete. BEP.
CMS determined BEP.
Yeah. So CMS put a BEP goal on this contract, and the non-responsive bidders, both did not meet the BEP goal, but then also didn't include enough information in their submission about why they didn't meet it, or that there was a good faith effort that they attempted to meet it. so that they were not evaluated, and we have IBOR. So $12.5 million over the five-year term. Shauna, do you have
anything? There is one year renewal to that.
Okay, one renewal beyond the 5 years.
Beyond 5 years available.
One renewal option.
Mm-hmm. And how does this compare with the old contract?
It's about 15% higher in terms of cost, but that has been a little bit anticipated.
That was also 5 years.
5 years?
Yeah. And that's what, I mean, they're responsible for the actual distribution of this.
To all the different retail locations, yeah. They're also responsible for the packaging and things of the transponders and the boxes, the bags, and the inserts and everything else. And they do all that assembly at their warehouse. They keep like a 3 month inventory on hand so you can just in time. And
don't ask any more
questions.
We've
got a couple. No,
good, I'm going to come up here.
Any questions? So,
if there are any questions, I'll take a motion to approve and pass on to the full board.
Motion.
Sir.
If there's any discussion, questions, seeing none, do we need a roll call? All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? That passes on to board. Public comment? None. Unfinished business? I think we've gone over all the unfinished business. Is there any new business you brought before the committee? Seeing none, we will stand in adjournment. We don't have any executive session, right? Not that I'm aware of. We'll stand in adjournment without objection. Thank you very much.
Thank you.